Going to keep that in a holding pattern, probably.
Call for the blue man. There we are. Thank you. Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for Friday, February 13th. And we have a quorum.
Yes, we do.
Open up a work session for the purpose of introducing LLCs as committee bills. We have a motion here.
Mr. Chair, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 965, dated 10-2-14. LC 3416, dated 2-10-15. LC 2578, dated 2-12-15. And LC 3679, dated 2-12-15.
Representative Nose moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 965, dated 10-2-14. LC 3416, dated 2-10-15. LC 2578, dated 2-12-15. LC 3679, dated 2-12-15. I'll remind everybody that introducing a bill as a committee bill in no way endorses any of those bills, nor do we automatically assume that they'll come to our committee for consideration. Is there any discussion about the acceptance of those LCs as to be introduced as a committee bill? Is there any objection? So moved. Close the work session, open up a public hearing on HB 2390. Representative Olson, somebody willing to protect you, is that right?
Yes, sir.
He's gone.
Happy.
He's got three black belts, sir. So
there are also a couple more. If you want them all up at the same time, that would be fine. Who else do we have?
Actually, do have two more members, Sandy.
Do you want them to join you now?
Oh, we could, actually. Might as well.
Either way.
Sure.
Yeah.
Your call.
Madam Administrator, you tell us what we have here.
Bring one of the chairs up.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. What we have here is HB 2390, which grants employers who offer employees to participate in a workplace wellness program up to a $300 federal taxable deduction. Specifies what a workplace wellness program is. It applies to the tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2016. This does have a subsequent referral to revenue.
Okay. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Andy Olson, state representative out of the Albany area, and appreciate this opportunity to come before you with this. House Bill 2390, it's a simple measure which creates a subtraction from federal taxable income for up to $300 in cash dividends paid by an employer to an employee for participation in a workplace wellness program. The goal of the plan is threefold: to increase access, to increase quality, and to reduce costs. Currently, and you're all familiar with this, there are a number of organizations that have developed a similar plan that fosters a healthier workplace and provides a reward to employees for making healthy life choices. The Public Employees Benefit Board, PEB, which is the health engagement model, HEM, and the Samaritan Healthcare Services out of Corvallis, between three different counties and five different hospitals, are both seeing large benefits in keeping people healthy. Participation in the voluntary worksite wellness program is independent on an initial health assessment. Based upon individual outcome of this assessment, employees participate in one or more of the following: a fitness program, weight control program, a nutritional educational program, and a tobacco use cessation or prevention program. Obvious benefits are improved health status of employees, employers' businesses receiving a healthier workplace, and workers' compensation costs decrease and health claim costs either decrease or do not increase. And with that, I have three members with that would like to testify. Dr. Jack Lees, who's kind of the brainchild of this, and I think, you know, Chair, you're familiar with him from before, so.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Dr. John Lees from Albany, Oregon. You have a binder there. I wanted to start, and I'll go through this pretty quickly, on page 2. The health care insurance has, we've tried to help solve the health care problem of cost and access by changing the system. This is a different approach. It's trying to change lifestyles by using financial incentives. We've done it in Albany in our office quite successfully. At the bottom of page 2 is an example of what we do. We have a one-mile walk test that they do twice a year, and there's a little graph that tells you how you fit in, how you fit there. We have another graph on weight control. That's your BMI, height and weight. They've signed a non-smoker's affidavit, and they attend health educational programs. That's what our employees do. And it's worked very well in Albany. The page 3 kind of shows what is going on in healthcare. That blue is our lifestyles, and these are different groups. The CDC is 40%. I don't have that here, but the other two is it comes out about 40%, and so 60% are the diagnosing and treatment of illnesses. 40% is lifestyles that create the problems. The amount of money that goes into healthcare is somewhere around $3 trillion. How much of that money goes into the blue is very, very little. And this is a movement in that direction to work on weight control, walking fitness, smoking cessation, and health education. Page 4 is the some articles that shows that money, a financial incentive, can change behavior. We have it. We give them a separate check each month. If I took that check away from them, there'd be a rebellion. And they're very proud of what they're doing. Now, the number 7 starts. Thomas Glogau is our CPA, and he's kind of worked through this. You lose money up front. You risk money up front. However, if we get improvement very quickly, like it's 6.5% decrease through wellness programs and healthcare costs, the corporations make money because healthcare insurance is a cost. If you reduce that, it flows to the bottom line to profits, which are taxed, federal and state. And so if a robust wellness program, and I think that's been being shown across the state, even at the med school, and then in our area, Samaritan Health, we found significant improvements in health and decrease in healthcare costs.
Dr. Lees, if I can ask a question. If I can ask a question, please.
Sure.
Maybe you're not the right one to answer. If this works so well and flows to the bottom line, why would you need a tax incentive to do it? It seems to me any corporation would be well ahead of the game to just do it.
Yeah. I think what employees look at is a leadership team. They look at you folks as leaders in the healthcare area because it has become very political. They look at employers. They look at insurance companies. So we team together and create leadership, and everybody has a little stake in the game. The state would have a stake, a small risk. Employer has a risk. But the people that do all the work are the employees. So our concept is kind of a team leadership approach, which empowers employees to move in this direction.
Well, I understand that, but the question remains: let's say we don't do this. Does that mean businesses are going to stop doing it? You say it goes to the bottom line, then why do you need a $300? Incentive to do it. Why not just do it?
Mr. Chair, I think I know exactly where you're going with the question. But I do think that there is probably an alternative. I mean, I don't think you're not opposed to wanting to try to make a more healthy Oregon and a more healthy environment. I think we're all of that mindset. Whether it would be a tax deduction or some other means of trying to get the as Dr. Lee's referred to, a skin in the game on both sides, that's something that I would be willing to have some further discussion on.
I think we'd have a better fiscal on it if we awarded everybody a certificate or a flag to fly on a healthy corporation. I mean, that's serious. If that's what we're talking about, trying to get some state recognition.
Okay, so again, Mr. Chair, just to follow up then with what I'm hearing, it sounds like you're interested. You think I should probably move forward with an amendment to address that
issue? I think we should hear the testimony. I'm sorry that I interrupted.
Okay, on page 9, we have a letter from former Senator Frank Morris, who used incentives in his employment before he went into politics, and actually he had a very good experience doing essentially what we're doing. And then I don't know if you remember Senator May Yee, but she's all over this and likes this very much. And we started way back in the 80s with smoking, and she's very proud of that. The insurance commissioner has looked on this, is this page 12, and has found that it would work. And there's a statement to that. Then there's these little free sheets in the back showing that getting paid to lose weight works, and group challenges work. And so the workplace environment where people are together 40 hours a week, if you can get them incentivized, they help each other. And I think it works. And then the second one here is just the cost of medical care in the United States is huge, and that we have some numbers there. And just the inactivity, obesity, diet, and smoking are huge. And it could be 40% of the health care costs. The next page on this free one is very interesting. Almost 36% of Oregon residents report exercising regularly, so there's a lot of upside there. The highest rate of any state in the country. The percentage, 16 is the percent of Washington, D.C. residents who report work on a regular basis, the lowest in the nation. So I think we have a stake in this, a leadership position, and I think if we can build that out and go from 36 to 40 to 45 to on up, we're going to save a lot of money, and the people are going to be a lot healthier. And then the final one is around the nation, and it shows what each state pays per person for health care, and we're in the between 25 and 50%. Washington, D.C. is the highest in the nation, over $10,000 per patient, per person. In Oregon, it's $6,500.
Thank you.
So,
thank you very much. We'll ask questions at the end, I think. Yes, go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. I'm Wayne Sheeler. My background's in sports medicine, fitness, personal training in the past, so a personal feeling to these clients that we're trying to reach. I'm here with Gym Sensor, an Oregon-based wellness accountability company, something that's needed in a program like this. A Gym Sensor focuses to implement systems that create accountability and provide a return on investment. Representative Olson has put forth a bill, 2390, that is clear in definition, one that promotes a better and more productive work environment and reduces the burden on the state healthcare system. Financially, it has the strength to promote and the motivation necessary for more individuals to action. Bill 2390 identifies four programs that lead to a healthier lifestyle. Four programs: the fitness program, the weight control, nutritional education, and the tobacco cessation and prevention program. Numerous research from the National Institute of Health, Institute of Neurological Disorder and Stroke, the Health and Human Services, as well as scientific journals and medical associations, support the fact that these programs have a direct correlation with improved health. Healthy lifestyles bring about a reduction in both chronic and acute health care costs, which will benefit the state. Gym Sensor is committed to providing an accountability system that will capture user participation of health programs. We believe this data collection will improve wellness results and achieve the best possible return on investment. The time is now, the technology exists now, to move forward with a bill such as this. Gym Sensor supports Bill 2390 and is committed to bringing accountability and transparency to the success of this bill. Chair Greenlick, to address one of your questions in regards to corporations footing the bill right up front, it doesn't address the state-funded system in which some people are a part of. It also would promote, if this committee would lead to run a pilot for a time frame in which to promote something like this, those corporations would be more likely to jump on board, see that initial benefit that they see, and at that point, I think it could roll into something in which you kind of see. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Ostlison, and I'm the executive director of the YMCA in Albany, Oregon, and I've had previous tours of duty with the YMCA in Colorado Springs and Portland and Charlotte, summing up some 35 years. I've seen various efforts toward health and lifestyle across the country, and I want to say that I'm here in support of House Bill 2390 and appreciate the opportunity to testify. In Albany, we have about 100,000 visits a year to the YMCA. Most of those people are in search of some way to improve their health and well-being, whether it's as an individual or a family. And they have pretty well-documented information, as was evidenced earlier here today, on the benefits of a healthy lifestyle. Probably don't need to drill down a lot on that. I'd simply conclude that it's a way people want to enjoy a fuller sense of health and well-being, live life to the fullest. So for us, we see three things that are necessary to help people accomplish that. First is support. It's hard to go it alone. We've got more than 120 people that are fledgling into this year once again in the January membership campaign, and we are hopeful that we'll see them in 90 days and not wonder where they went. So you heard about the 90-day wonders. Our goal is to hang on to them for a long time. So giving them the support they need, whether that be through family members or, in this particular case, coworkers and friends and neighbors, is a really important factor in sticking with it. When we have done both community weight loss challenges and company weight loss challenges, we have found that the spirit of connection in people who already have an affinity for spending time together is a tremendous influencer in whether or not they'll stay with a program and report success. Secondly, as Wayne is pointing out, expertise is really a critical element. We don't all grow up in this culture. Many companies don't have the expertise in this culture, and perhaps not entirely comfortable with being able to roll this out with some help from local community leadership. It's been our experience. We've been asked many times to actually come in and conduct community weight loss challenges for businesses. So something we are happy to do. But a qualified and effective staff team in a culture of caring can make all the difference in the world, help people pursue a healthy lifestyle. That could be a coach, could be an instructor, could be a counselor, but it has to be someone who understands that there's a need to connect with people. And lastly, they need encouragement, probably more important than anything else. Our experience has been that initial and ongoing encouragement at the right time and at the right place creates an opportunity for a small one-degree shift in behavior that maybe points a person in the direction toward a healthier lifestyle. And that's what it's all about, is to be able to say, here's a way to go. We're here every step of the way. To do that collectively in a workplace is extremely powerful. The other part about this that I'm attracted to is we know people respond to financial incentives, whether it's an interest rate on a long-term mortgage, whether it's a Black Friday sale, or whether it's a little something that puts my pocketbook in a better position, at the same time gives me some sense of accountability to take better care of myself. We know that those work. It might just be the difference between someone making a step toward a healthier lifestyle or not. I was pleased to see Dr. Lee's comment and statement about 35% of Oregonians leading the charge in terms of those that exercise regularly. That's the good news. The not so good news is another 65% that we need to bring up and along, and this could help us maybe kickstart that. We already have an affinity in this state, unlike many others, toward a healthy lifestyle. Perhaps this will help us set a faster pace toward that.
Can I ask you to wrap up, please?
I will. Thank you very much. So what I'd like to suggest is if we can put these together in a spirit of community leadership, that maybe we can not only lower health care costs, but we can make healthier Oregon, not just for this generation, but for many to come. Thank you.
Are there questions?
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for my clarity, would this be a tax benefit for the employer and or the employee? Is it both?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, it's designed for the employer to seek after, and then it's then shifted toward the employee.
So employer costs would go down, and the employee also would have a little bit less on their income tax, presumably, because it's a tax-free up to...
My understanding, that's correct.
Okay. Follow up?
Please. I'm not sure that's true.
Okay.
But I need to look at the bill.
Okay.
It seems there is a tax incentive for the employer, which would be rewarding the employees for
So it says there shall be subtracted from federal taxable income an amount not to exceed $300 equal to any cash dividends that are paid by an employer to an employee. So I just couldn't tell. Do they both, if it's tax-free,
get it. I mean, but it would be flowed through, Mr. Chair, President Kenny Geyer would be flowed through.
Right. So maybe on the employer side, they have a reduction in payroll taxes or something like that because the gross is brought down, and on the person, an employee would get an income tax reduction, I'm guessing, but maybe you can let us know afterwards. And then the other...
I don't think so.
No?
No. We can check the bill later. This is a tax benefit to the employer
to
offset the money the employer is giving in the reward system to the employees.
So the employee who's getting a little more cash is fully responsible for the increase in income, then. Is that correct?
It's $300
a
year.
So right.
He's getting, they'll be paid $25 a month to participate in the program.
Right. They taxable can just ride, income.
Right. Taxable income. The employer can write off paying the employee.
Okay. So the benefit to the employer, not to the employee. And
the benefits to both.
Any other states? Have any other states done this?
Dr. Lee, is any other states doing anything like this?
Something's going on in Ohio, but I'd have to research it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Senator Widener?
Okay.
Well done? Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Wait.
Chairman, quick question. Thank you, Dr. Lees, for a great presentation. I appreciate the research that's gone into this proposal. It's very nicely done. In your experience, what are the barriers to employers starting a program such as this?
To employers? Well, of course, the money. Mm-hmm. You know, we pay out, we pay a little more than this, $60 a month or so that. And then it takes a little bit of time. You have to manage the educational part of it.
Right.
We meet once a month and 20 minutes education. So it's the work that's involved. Mm-hmm. But I think once the employers catch the spirit of what's going on and get the feedback from the employees, I think they're on board pretty quick.
One quick follow-up.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Would it be acceptable to use this as an incentive to start the program then have it expire so that you get over the hurdles of the status quo of starting such a program?
That's a possibility, and that's a good thought. But you'll notice in a lot of literature, people will stop smoking or lose weight. I think something like 80% of the people that lose weight regain it. And I don't know what the when people give up smoking when they come back. This is a continuous thing. So they're meeting monthly, and it just goes on and on. And I think that catches that group that will do it for a while and then stop. And I think Jim has experienced that at the Y. You want to keep them involved. And one of the things that keeps them involved is just the friendships. It's a group thing.
I think we need to move on if we what's that? I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2390 and work with the sponsor and see what we can do. I hate to see this just go over to revenue and they get killed because it had a huge impact. So. You and I.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming to testify. Is Nancy here?
She's planning on being second. So.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2231. Could you see if you can find Representative Nathanson?
Here
she comes. She was right there ready.
She was right there.
Do you want to call the other two to focus attention?
No. Madam Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HB 2231 prohibits coordinated care organizations from requiring organizational providers to produce information that is redundant and duplicative with respect to or outside the scope of on-site quality assessment of the organizational provider conducted by the Oregon Health Authority. Thanks.
Good job. Representative Nathanson, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Nancy Nathanson, a representative from District 13. That's lots of multi-syllable words.
I know.
This is a lot of bureaucratic and administrative stuff to talk about. Mental health and chemical dependency providers, treatment providers, must go through multiple authorization processes to operate in different CCO regions. Providing services to children and adults, if it's in different regions for coordinated care organizations, if you're providing services to multiple CCOs, that means multiple processes, multiple authorizations, multiple credentialing. It's mostly an unnecessary use of time. It's costly, very costly, to the providers who are trying to manage essential programs that we rely on, but they're doing it on a shoestring budget. It's taking time and money away from what should be the main task, serving the people that face severe behavioral and mental health issues. And it uses up CCO resources as well to do this. So begs the question, why are we doing it this way? We had been doing it this way. In 2013, the Oregon Legislature passed House Bill 2020, which was intended to eliminate redundant credentialing processes, especially the licensing and credentialing of human services. The objective of the bill was to reduce the number of duplicative administrative processes and establish a more streamlined credentialing process to avoid wasting time on unnecessary administrative work. It would have allowed providers to focus more time and resources on serving their clients in the communities. A few examples I'd like to bring to your attention as a reminder of the problem that we were trying to address then and we still need to address. There's one important provider in Oregon that spends more than $320,000 a year and 7 FTE staff on auditing and reporting requirements. Another example you may have heard about through written testimony is from an organization called Options. The organization is undergoing two different certification reviews in Lane and Multnomah counties. In addition to these ongoing, it also had certification reviews in Clackamas County in November of 2014 and in Marion County in March of 2014. The road has been bumpy. CCOs expressed that they too benefit from streamlining, as well as the providers. Despite sincere efforts at making things better, we're still not completely there yet. There are apparently some roadblocks to reducing the number of credentialing processes. There there was some hurry-up credentialing activity before the bill became effective. And because these contracts are for multiple years, there is currently, probably, in the statistics, a lull in credentialing activity. That lull, maybe that's okay, that gives time to work out the problems that remain so that future contracting and credentialing will go more smoothly. This bill is designed to be a vehicle to make sure that progress continues, that the objective we had before, streamlining and reducing and eliminating multiple audits, that's where we get to. Once a program provider is vetted and found to be qualified by one CCO, they should be recognized as qualified for providing services and billing with other CCOs. In the last week, I have heard from several different parties about several efforts to remedy this situation, about some fairly new developments in the past year, about things that are timely, something may be imminent, there may be progress. Because I've heard that there may be ways to address the problem, I think it would be useful to get all the parties together again and see what else can be done to reach the objective. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd very much like if you'll take the lead in doing that. I would like to get this straightened out. I have talked to CCO representatives. It does seem like it's a possible thing. It just isn't all that complicated. So, yes, I'm going to ask OHA and the CCO folks to work with you to see if we can get this cleaned up, either straighten out the bill in a way that serves its function or maybe even have to do away with the bill. We're going to hear some testimony about this, and I appreciate you bringing it to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let me call the next panel. Janet Ahrens, Craig Opperman, Stephen Allen. And I'm going to ask you all to please try and be brief. Now we've got a bunch of work to do today, including some purple folks to talk to before we're done. Brief, but tell us what we need to know.
You got it. Thank you, Chair Greenlick and committee members. We appreciate being here today. So, and we are very appreciative of the offer to bring everybody together. That is part of what we want to address in our testimony. We think that can be very productive. So, just to illustrate briefly.
Please introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. I'm Janet Ahrens, the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. We're a statewide nonprofit representing $223 million in, see, I'm very good when I'm prompted, $223 million worth of services for over 100,000 children. We represent about 5,500 employees and $152 million in payroll every year. So the Oregon Health Authority, through the Oregon Health Authority, providers are certified as behavioral health providers. They also have a comparable process for identifying who's qualified to be a CCO. So then we have the CCOs coming over here to take another look at credentialing the providers that have already been certified under the same system. So that was what we tried to address in our bill last session that Representative Nathanson spoke about. So as she said, there's been a few bumps in the road. We haven't quite gotten there. There are some efforts on behalf of the Oregon Health Authority to establish a couple of credentialing banks that would have the potential to possibly alleviate some issues with both the individuals who are credentialed inside programs as well as the programs themselves. They are not completed. We don't know if they're going to be acknowledged by national accrediting bodies for the CCOs. So there are still several unknowns out there. And in the meantime, until we find out the answers to those questions, we're still basically in very much the same circumstances that we were in 2 years ago with the original bill. And speaking to this bill and the consequences, the bill emerged with those consequences as written by Legislative Council. We did not ask for those consequences. Those were not our suggestions or recommendations. What we asked for was some existing process inside The Oregon Health Authority that regulates and monitors CCOs have an accountability clause where they had to demonstrate that they were operating in ways that was successfully eliminating these redundancies and the duplications. And that is still our objective in moving the bill forward. The currently, as Representative Nathanson spoke to, we do have some relief. We have seen some emerging issues in some other areas, and we're hopeful that the efforts that are in play now, including an opportunity for everybody to get to the table and visit about how else we might be able to accomplish these things, will result in the savings of provider costs, of disruption in treatment, and will reactivate access to services that are reduced as a result of the processes. So the long and the short of it is that even though audits, credentialing, and reviews may be necessary, it is not necessary to complete them in the same manner in which we're going forward today. And with the CCOs, and some conversation with the health authority, surely we'll find some efficient middle ground between what is required and how many times it's required. And I have some of my members with me here today, and they're going to speak to some personal circumstances. Thank you.
Hi, thank you. I'm Craig Opperman. I'm with Looking Glass Youth and Family Services in Lane County, a member of the Alliance, very much a supporter of the CCOs as well as the providers. Quickly, as a way of opening, and I'll be brief, but I was going to comment on how Friday the 13th is typically a lucky day for me. But considering the situation in the building today, that might not be the best thing to reference. I'll make a different quick reference for you that's really irrelevant. It's Chuck Yeager's birthday today, who is the pilot that was the first human to go faster than the speed of sound. Yes. I'm not expecting that we go warp speed on all these things right now, but we've got to have a situation that brings us all together to streamline these processes that you've heard about, that you're going to hear about. The CCOs and the providers are partners in this. We want the same thing. We go through a rigorous qualifying process to know that we're providing safe, quality services to those we serve. And the CCOs want that as well as we do. Right now, when we do that repeatedly, it takes money away from the clients and customers we're trying to serve. This bill might not be the perfect solution to that, but it's at least a starting ground for us to get together and make this work out the way it should. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Steve Allen from Options Counseling Services, and I think people have spoken pretty eloquently about various issues with this bill, so I will keep this very short. I think there's one of the issues with HB 2020 is that it had a goal in mind, but it's hard to know who's responsible for completing the goal. And I'm very hopeful hearing that people will get together and talk. I think that there's confusion between what belongs to the CCOs, what's the Oregon Health Authority, and what authority still rests with counties. And so we're currently undergoing 3 audits in 6 months over the same material. I think the only other thing I want to add is that it's not just the time of duplicating the information for the audits, but whenever you get a team of people coming in looking at the same rules from a different perspective, you get a different interpretation of the rules. So we also struggle with standardization within our organization. Even though we're operating under one set of rules, we have to tailor our policies for each region to meet their interpretation. So I'm hopeful that whatever comes out of this will be a unified application of the rules by one entity.
A question to this panel. Thank you very much. Call the next panel, please.
Tim Murphy, Monica Ford, and Rose Burke.
Rose. Introduce yourself to begin the testimony.
Yes, I've never been here before, so this is scary.
No, calm down.
Chair,
we're not having witnesses here.
I'm here to kind of give you the nuts and bolts about what everybody's talking about with this bill, because I'm the mainline person who does this day in and day out. Can you hear me okay? My name is Rose Burke, and I work for Albertina Care Centers. We're a nonprofit organization that handles I would say, helps families and children with mental health, developmental disabilities, and physical health issues, such as autism, hearing issues, and speech issues. Albertina Kerr has 859 employees, I think, as of Friday, last Friday, and I am the only person doing credentialing with the payers. So I want to give you kind of my challenges that I have with the payers on a day-to-day basis. I have statistical numbers and kind of scenarios to let you know why this process just doesn't work, not even if you had 10 employees. So I'll just get started with that.
Yes, try and hold it.
I'm sorry, I get excited.
Can be brief, please?
Brief. Oh, I 2 minutes.
Okay, that's great.
Okay.
I have wonderful.
Four challenges. I hope I don't talk too fast. Duplicating processes, as everyone else has spoke to, credentialing time frame, loss of revenue, and families. First of all, duplicating processes. Example, July 17th, 2014. The word practitioner, first I should probably tell you I credential 27 practitioners. Practitioners is doctors and therapists. Also nurse practitioners. I also credential 12 programs. I'm getting confused. I credential all of our programs with 12 payers. So I've got 27 practitioners and our programs that I credential. July 17, 2014, I sent a practitioner's application to a payer. October 8th, payer contacted me, and I had to resend it because they actually told me they couldn't find the application, so I had to resend the paperwork. November 6th, still haven't heard from the payer. I called them back, three people over 2 days, no response. I never heard again from the payer, so I just waited. 2 months later, January 22nd, 2015, last month, the payer emailed me and said that they did receive the paperwork on November 6th. Not the one I sent on the October 8th and the one they lost on July 7th, 17th, but the one on November 6th they had. They said it would be 90 days from November 6th before this doctor would be credentialed. That's exactly 7 months to credential one doctor. One doctor who cannot see any children. We cannot bill for that doctor's services, nothing. Right now I have five practitioners that are taking 7 months to get credentialed with the payers. Their normal time frame, they say, is 90 days. They're not taking 90 days. They're taking as long as they feel like taking to credential somebody. And I do credentialing. Albertina Kerr is an accreditation organization with the Joint Commission. I do credentialing myself. I can do it one person in 5 days, a few people in 2 weeks, maximum 4 weeks. I do the same process. Why is it taking them 90 days and 7 months?
That's
so that's my other issue. Pardon?
That's your 2 minutes.
Oh, already?
How about two more?
I get two more?
You get
sure.
Two more.
Thank you. Okay.
I might add, you're lucky.
Okay,
come on, keep going.
This is for
passion equals time, I think.
Three staff people, four payers. I know it's hard to picture. So we got three staff, four payers over a two-month period. Kerr lost $1,320 for doctor services, $1,886 for therapist service, $9,365.34 total over for the programs. So it's a total of $13,234.34, three staff, four payers, 2 months. Now, this doesn't even count how much we are paying the doctors and the therapists to sit around because they cannot see children because the payers will not pay the bills. So we're paying the doctor to sit there because they can't see the child because the insurance company is not going to reimburse us. Now, not to mention, the real tragedy in all of this is our kids. So we've got a family out there that calls our clinic organization and says, my child has hearing problems and I need to see a hearing specialist. The billing department checks their insurance. Oh, I'm sorry, you have family care. The doctor's not credentialed with or this therapist isn't credentialed with family care. The therapist or the doctor themselves, not our billing department, will call me and say, Rose, when am I going to be credentialed? And I have to say back like a fool, I have no idea, because I don't know how long family care is going to take. And if I call family care, you know what they're going to say? It's in process. That's the only words they know, all of them across the board, all 14 pairs. It's in process. Okay, so now I feel like the bad guy, because here we've got, it's bad enough that when, you know, these families that are having to deal with children with these issues, and now they find an organization that is actually going to be able to help them, and they can't even get on the schedule. So, I mean, that's the real tragedy in all of this. Also, I know I'm almost done. On top of the 12-page Oregon application that the payers, we have to fill out, now, 3 months later, 3 months ago, the payers all said, oh, we also made up our own paperwork we want you to fill out. Here it is. I want Cigna, Family Care, Pacific Source, United Healthcare. I can go on. I want to fill this stuff out, too.
That's your second. To make, would you please longer. Wrap it up?
And this is how much paperwork it takes to credential one pro, with one payer. 150 pages.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
2 minutes.
Well, that's a tough act to follow. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Monica Ford, and I work for Morrison Child and Family Services. It's a large mental health and social service organization in the Tri-County area. And I've had the unique privilege of working for Morrison for 34 years. And believe me, since 1981, I've seen a lot of changes. And unfortunately, the changes I've seen have been onerous. I almost introduced myself as I'm frustrated and I'm exasperated. I share a lot of what how Rose feels, because it is a burden on agencies who are trying to serve children and families to have to go through these things. We have CCOs, we have other state regulatory agencies coming through wanting to interview our staff. They ask them, do you like your job? And is there anything you'd like to change? And routinely they say, yes, I'd like to serve clients. Unfortunately, because of the burden of the regulatory process, it, a lot of times we can't even see the kids we're supposed to see and the families who want deeply to have their children have a better outcome. So I don't want to take any more time other than to tell you we're the ones who represent the 7 FTE and the slightly south of $500,000 per year to do this work. When I started at Morrison, we had program evaluation. We've always done program outcome. We want to know what we do works. We now have a larger quality management program just to handle the credentialing and the oversight of all these different organizations that we contract with than actually looking at what it is we do for kids. Thank you.
You ought to take their example. They only have one person.
Yeah. She just does the credentialing.
I see. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Murphy. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Bridgeway Recovery Services, which is a mental health and chemical dependency medical clinic here in Salem, and provide the services that Representative Nathanson was talking about just a few minutes ago. I really just want to add my voice to this question about administrative burden that is currently occurring as a result of the way we've set up the delivery of healthcare. Oregon is a national leader in a lot of healthcare arenas, and we're really proud to be practitioners in Oregon. But this piece needs to be fixed. You heard it really clearly from Rose. You heard it from Representative Nathanson, from Monica, and from the others that testified. And it's an easy fix, but it needs to be fixed. It needs your support, not only to get a meeting together where people talk, but to set some expectation of when the results can be come back so that we can fix it. Because in addition to the administrative burden that providers are experiencing, what it also means is Oregonians aren't getting the health care they need. We're not getting people into treatment quick enough because we aren't getting our providers credentialed by the credentialing bodies. So I appreciate your support for the bill. Thank you for your time.
Are there questions to this panel? Yes, sir.
Chair Greenlick, thank you. One, maybe more, a little bit of a comment. This week alone, I have personally received three credentialing, and they are re-credentialing requirements. So I'm wondering, is there anything in the bill to help streamline the large amount of paperwork that providers go through to do the re-credentialing in it? And out of 5 pages on this bill, if you get down to the last line, line 28, line 29, it says, refers to the body of the bill, but then it says, unless it's necessary to request the information by the CCO. So it kind of seems like it almost negates the whole bill with those last two lines. So I really encourage the people that are involved with this, including the providers, the CCOs, the insurance companies, to get together and try and resolve this in the industry, because it's really hard for a legislative body, I think, to know all those nuances. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Hayden.
And OHA is a piece of that. I think that's well, thank you all very much. I see OHA representatives in the room. I expect there's CCO representatives, too. I really have asked Representative Nathanson to get together with you. It seems to me, I know there's NCQA issues involved in this. There's database issues in this. But it's an absolutely simple thing to do when one CCO has certified a treatment agency. That should be plenty. So let's see if you can straighten this out, or we're going to have to just go through and pass the bill without straightening it out in advance. I'll close the public hearing on HB 2231. We have all the material to do a work session on 2294 for the purpose of moving it to Ways and Means. Is that right?
Well, Mr. Chair, it does have a, yes, it is ready to be moved, but we have gotten permission to remove the Ways and Means referral. So,
okay.
So did you want to open the work session on that now?
Let's see. We need to have a motion to do that, to remove the?
Yes.
Okay, I'll open a work session on House Bill 2294, and we have a motion.
Well, Mr. Chair, we had a public hearing on this bill last week. At that time, there was recommendations for an amendment, and you have before you the Dash 1 amendment, which the Dash 1, this, I'll just back up. It requires the Oregon Health Authority to establish the Oregon Health Information Technology Program. You remember this was the bill that talked about our IT system and the collaborative public partnership, and make some other technical fixes. The Dash 1 amendment expands the authority's scope to include certain activities that support the Oregon HIT program. It clarifies the procurement procedures, and it adds the requirement that OHA report to the Legislative Assembly annually. And so we have a fiscal impact on the Dash 1. It also specifies what it's codifying, and the fiscal impact on the bill is minimal. With that, the Speaker has given the committee permission, if it so chooses, to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
So we need a motion on the amendment. We need a motion on the rescission.
Yes.
And then we need a motion on the bill.
Yes, and I have that right here.
Okay.
Who do you wish to?
Let me ask, is there any discussion on this bill before we go forward? Is everybody ready to vote on it? It seems to me, you remember, pretty straightforward.
Great bill.
Yeah. Okay.
It's made life simpler.
Do you want to go there?
Somebody.
Okay.
Also, think about a volunteer for carrying it.
Chair Greenlit, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment stated 2915.
Representative Hayden moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2294. Is there any discussion on that motion? Is there any objection? So moved. Okay, we need a motion now on the rescission.
Chair Green.
Yes.
Chair Greenlink, I move House Bill 2294 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to the committee on Ways and Means.
No.
That's all we want.
Yes.
I thought you said we rescind. Oh, and then we rescind.
Just
let
trust
him set it.
Okay. Sorry, this is only our second week. We're still getting used to driving the car.
The problem when you have a new administrator who's only been with us about 9 years, I should trust you.
Okay, would you?
How long has she been with us?
I can't remember.
Well, there you go.
It's 2007.
Read faster.
Yeah.
Chair, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2294 as amended to the House floor and due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Okay.
There we go.
Good
job.
President Hayden moves House Bill 2294 as amended be moved to the House floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the prior referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Oh. That was the verbiage you were looking for.
That's what I was looking for. Is that the right verbiage? It is good today, huh?
It is.
Moving right ahead.
Is there any discussion on this? Would you please call the roll?
Brett Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Excuse.
Representative Kennemer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Noakes?
Aye.
Chair Greenlake?
Aye. Motion passes. Do I have a volunteer to carry it?
Representative Lively stepped up.
I do it.
Yay, Representative Lively.
You did all the work on that.
That's supposed to help you get any information you need on it. Okay, I will close the work session on House Bill 2294 and open a. Which are we going? Where are we going next? Yeah, open a public hearing on HCR 14. What's HCR 14, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, HCR 14 designates March 26, 2015 as Purple Day to raise awareness of epilepsy.
Well, I had the honor of calling a past speaker to the table. Is that right?
Yeah.
Karen Minnis, please.
Is she here?
Yeah, she is.
Yes, yeah, she is. And one other, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, after. Well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Speaker Minnis.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Alyssa Kenny Geyer, and I represent House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland, and I'm very honored to be the chief sponsor of this bill. I'm sorry that neither Senator Jackie Winters nor Representative Catty McEwen could be here. They're both sponsors with me, and I know that Senator Winters has some materials on OLIS in support of this bill, and Representative Catty McEwen is very supportive. She has someone very close to her in her life that has epilepsy, as do I, and so that is part of our passion for this. And I just want to say that I'm excited by this. I want to leave enough time for someone who I didn't have the privilege to overlap with in the House here, but as well as speakers who will be talking about how this impacts their lives. But is the most common neurological disorder. 1 out of 10 people will suffer an epileptic seizure in their life, and 1 out of 26 will actually develop epilepsy. And the purpose of having a Purple Day on March 26th, and the advocates didn't know this, but purple is my favorite color, and March 26th is the day that I got engaged to my husband, so I'm particularly happy about that. But the purpose of this is to bring awareness to this, because many people do not recognize the signs of a seizure and don't know how to respond to it. And in addition to that, we would like to bring more awareness so that we can encourage research to both find a cure and also help find preventative strategies. So with that, I am honored to bring you this HCR 14.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Karen Minnis. I'm here on behalf of myself and my family. Today is my mother's, would have been her 85th birthday.
Mm.
And lavender is her favorite color. So it's appropriate that I came today to talk about this particular bill. HCR 14 does address an issue that is very close to my heart. My mother suffered from grand mal epilepsy all of her life. Mm-hmm. And as children, we had 6 of us in a small little house. She would have seizures, and she would scream when she'd have the seizure and would send us all in a panic out the door, because we didn't quite know at that age how to help her. Later on in my life, when I was 7 years old, I developed petit mal epilepsy and suffered for 7 years with that disorder, including walking from 23rd and Division to school on 8th and Orange in Representative Noss's district to go to grade school. And my sister, I a couple of times had a seizure in the middle of Division Street, and my sister couldn't move me. I would just kind of freeze. And so I dealt with this condition a good part of my life. HCR 14 does bring awareness, and it is my hope that more people will come to understand the disease. That if you have this disease, it doesn't necessarily, people I think ascribe a stigma that's attached to this disorder, but in fact, people can live a very productive life with this. I am very much in support of this bill, and I hope this is only the beginning, and that as people come to know and understand this disease, they will help with research as well as move forward to help us find a cure. Actually, one of my children ended up with a Petit-Mal. So to look at that little face and realize what's happening to them was rather frightening. They've since outgrown it. But I do have an extended family member who suffers as well from epilepsy. They say it's not hereditary, but boy, it seems to run pretty much in our family. And unfortunately, that extended family member is disabled from it and is not able to function well with it. So I would encourage you to move this bill out, move it to the floor, and on the 26th of March, I will be wearing purple proudly and happily. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your time.
Thank you. Are there any questions in this panel? Thank you. Well, we have two more witnesses we'll call. Is that right?
Three
more witnesses. Please call.
Ray L. Stewart. Is it Caitlin Stewart? And Kelly Cobb?
Yes.
Welcome, folks.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself to start your testimony.
Thank you for having us, Chair Greenlake and the rest of the representatives here. I am Raylan Stewart, and they will do much better than I because it is very, very hard on me. This is something that I'm very passionate about. I actually work for the Epilepsy Foundation Northwest, and we serve three states, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska, but I'm based in the Beaverton area. And my daughter here will share a little bit, but she lives with epilepsy and was diagnosed just over 8 years ago. And at that time, she was having 1.2 seizures every minute, missed 3 to 30 seconds out of every minute, having absent seizures. That lasted for about 4.5 years. And then on Christmas morning, December 2011, she had her second grand mal seizure that lasted 13 minutes. She no longer has petit mal seizures, although she does still have grand mal tonic-clonic seizures, and they are very random. We never know when they're going to happen, but she just had one. Her last one was December 31st on New Year's Eve in the afternoon, and hit her head, her cheek, and her hip, and so. Year and a half prior to that, well, she was 45-week seizure-free, which was a great thing because they were coming monthly. And prior to that, year and a half prior, she nearly died because she hit her head. And so this is something that does happen, and the injuries that can cause any type of seizure, but she does. It does affect her in her schooling. It does affect her in her sports. She, thankfully and gratefully, we have fought for her rights in school. She does attend Sunset High School in Beaverton, and she's a senior graduating this year. And so it's wonderful. We're very excited. What I see is HCR 14 bringing for us and the epilepsy community is just more awareness, because sometimes you go into the schools, and I know Kelly and Rachel have had this, is you just feel so alone because you're going and there's so much unknown about epilepsy still, the stigma of it. And I think bringing that to a day that brings awareness that what I do, my job, is to build the relationships in the community, in the whole state of Oregon, and to advocate, to bring awareness to how to respond to seizures for teachers, staff, families, police, fire, We go out and train all these people. So having that day designated, I believe, would bring great awareness and support.
Thank you. So who's next?
My name is Kelly Cobb. I live here in Salem with my husband and my daughter, Rachel, who is now 20 years old and had her first seizure 12 years ago, which was a huge shock. By the age of 8, you think you're all, you know, smooth sailing. Epilepsy is so many things. It's not just what we see on TV with the tonic-clonic seizures. And a lot of people wouldn't know to recognize one if they saw one that wasn't that, and they wouldn't know what to do. I'm a volunteer with the Epilepsy Foundation Northwest. My daughter, Rachel, has been the Oregon representative for Kids Speak Up in Washington, D.C. We spend quite a bit of time educating people about what epilepsy is. It's in our best interest to keep my daughter safe out there, you know. So this is a really big deal to us. You know, when we go out and it's March 26th and we see other people wearing purple, especially if it's families, we know they're part of our community. You know, they get it. We're around people that understand us. And
something special about that day in particular?
Actually, it was begun by a little girl who lives in Canada. It's actually an International Purple Day. The month of November is Epilepsy Awareness Month here in the U.S., but there's something about that one day that's kind of come to encompass the world for us in the community. And so having Oregon step up behind us and say we're recognizing this, you know, in Oregon for people that live here with this condition is very validating.
Thank you.
Also, just to say, like, when
please introduce
Caitlin
yourself.
Stewart, that to make it Purple Day would also show that people are supporting people with epilepsy and that they're not alone, and so that people are aware and ready to advocate for those with epilepsy so that they don't have to be there alone. And I think that's like the biggest thing for people with epileptics.
Are there questions in this panel?
Mr. Chair, I got a question.
Yes, sir.
What you're doing is a good thing. I have a son who's type 1 diabetic, and we had the same thing with the schools where they said, hey, you need to keep your insulin up in the office and everything up there, not realizing, okay, when you're low on your blood sugar, whatever, you can't get to the office when you have stairs to go up and things. And it's the same thing. It's just bringing awareness into our education system and so people know what to do when someone's having these. So I thank you for bringing this forward because there's a lot of awareness that needs to be brought out for more than just epilepsy. It's diabetes. There's Crohn's. There's lots of different things that children are suffering with out there that we need to make known to the public.
Thank you very much. I think
thank
we're
you.
Prepared to make it happen for this community.
Wonderful. Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on HCR 14 and ask Representative Kenny Geyer if she has a motion for us on this. I will open the work session.
Okay.
Yeah.
Unless you're out of the car.
Exactly.
Just make sure.
Okay.
Open the work session on HCR 14.
Mr. Chair, I move HCR 14 to the floor to be with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves HCR 14 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Please call the roll.
Representative Bueller?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
I'm sorry, Clem, excuse.
Representative Kennemer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlight?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Kenny Geyer and McEwen?
Yes.
Join the carry on the floor?
Yes, please.
Close the work session on HCR 14. I think we have one more to go. Is that right?
That is right, Mr. Chair.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2305. And Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HB 2305 allows individuals who have completed a PolySOM program, and I'm not going to try the long version, that combines education and training in the program and can apply for the PolySLAM technology license. There's no revenue. We have a dash one that they will be speaking to, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Who's going to start?
I would. Paul Cosgrove, Janice White, Erica Kennett. Kennett?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Paul Cosgrove representing Legacy Health, the sponsor of House Bill 2305. This bill addresses what the prerequisites are in order to obtain a license as a polysomnographic technologist. I tried. I'm sorry. I should have said
I think you did really good.
But even the name polysom is probably not terribly descriptive. We're talking about people who are sleep technicians in sleep labs. Anyway, this addresses the prerequisites. Back in 2011, this body passed the first licensing statute in Oregon, and Oregon is relatively in the distinct minority of states that actually require licensing or registration of these professionals. Only 14 states plus D.C. do require a license. And the prerequisites that you set forth in the statute in 2011 were pretty straightforward. High school graduation plus completion of an education or training program, or one that includes both education and training approved by the board, and that's the Board of Respiratory Therapists, which was renamed to be the Board of Respiratory Therapists and PolySOM by your bill in 2011, and then finally passing an examination approved by the board. The board thereafter adopted rules, and the rules that adopted by the board are really quite complicated and set forth five different pathways as prerequisites before they could take the examination by the board. And those pathways have strange and wondrous results, which these two ladies will explain to you in a few minutes, in that they have often ended with very qualified candidates, highly skilled candidates, not being able to qualify to take the exam in Oregon. And that's partly because in many professions, there's a degree of reciprocity across state lines. When there isn't a licensure or registration in most states, reciprocity doesn't work very well. So what we are proposing in 2305 is to change the prerequisites in one regard. I want to make really, really clear, because I think there's some misinformation about this bill, we are not proposing either to extend the grandfathering that existed in your 2011 bill, where you allowed the board and the board did grandfather all the existing practitioners. That's done. Nor are we trying to expand allowing people to get licenses with simple on-the-job training. That's also done. There is what we are proposing is to take what the board agrees is sort of the gold standard of national credentialing. It's a board of PolySOM, registered PolySOM technicians, which has itself decided there are prerequisites of training and experience in order to qualify for that examination, and we suggest that's the appropriate standard for Oregon to have as a pathway to licensure. Now, just to step back for a moment, what that means is the board nationally has six pathways. Three of them have a combination of education and training. The more complicated the education, the less training on the job training is required by that board, and vice versa. The simpler the educational requirements, all of these are certified programs, then more on-the-job training. And all of that is done before you can take the national boards. What we're proposing is if a candidate from another state who can't qualify for reciprocity because there isn't a reciprocal licensing statute, but who has taken one of those three combined education and training pathways and taken the national exam and passed it, and has, if they've done it in years past, they've kept up the requirements to keep it active, they ought to be able to apply for a license in Oregon. This is supported by any number of healthcare institutions who run sleep labs. There are several letters on OLIS from some of those institutions who are not here today to testify, but they include St. Charles, Salem Health, Providence, Portland Adventist, OHSU is here in the room, and the Oregon Association of Hospitals. If I may, Mr. Chair, I would rather turn it over to Ms. White, who will explain some of the impacts of not having this change made.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing us to come and speak to you. My name is Jan White, Janice, for the sake of the record. I am the registered respiratory therapist, and I am the manager of the respiratory care department, sleep disorder center, and cardiopulmonary departments for Legacy Good Samaritan, part of the Legacy Health System. And I'm here to speak to our experiences and the difficulties that we've had. First, I want to reiterate, as Mr. Cosgrove has said, that we are not asking that we replace education with purely experience. We are not requesting on-the-job training only. We are requesting that it be a combination of education and training and experience that has been recognized by the National Board, the Board of Registered Polysomnographic Technologists, and which is the gold standard for this field of study. The difficulty that we've been having within our own organization, and Legacy Health is a large organization, we have 5 sleep labs within the Oregon area. The difficulty we've had is attempting to acquire experienced individuals into the field. At this point in time, based on the restrictions of this licensure, we have extended our ability to hire to almost 98 days total turnaround, an average of 98 days, which can tell you that on either end of that, some people it takes even longer. That's from the point of entry into our application system until actual the point of offer. In that group, we have seen polysomnographic technologists from across the nation applying. We've also seen a large volume of respiratory care practitioners, many new graduates from the respiratory schools. The respiratory schools currently, I totally honor respiratory. I am a respiratory therapist. But their program does not have a high emphasis on the sleep component. Their clinical experience ranges anywhere from 6 to possibly 12 hours, sometimes up to 2 clinical rotation days in the sleep center. So they're not coming to us ready to work. They will require an extensive amount of experience on the job in training. We are also seeing that those applicants frequently come to us, and within their application, they're indicating that they're 2 to 5 year goal is to work in the acute care and critical care setting. That is not what sleep technology was about. A couple of examples of hires that we have attempted to make at our Legacy Mount Hood Medical Center, which is a 2-bed sleep center. We had an applicant who came to us. In a 2-bed sleep center, there's one technologist working with 2 patients at a time, so there's not the luxury of multiple people in the environment. This individual came to us from Arizona, applied to us from Arizona via California, actually, and he had came with 15 years of experience and held the credential by the National Board. He was not able to receive a license in the state of Oregon. He was willing to do a secondary form of education, which was a shorter term education, in order to acquire the ability. But at that point, he would have needed to have 18 months of direct supervision or indirect supervision, even, which would require that a supervisor be on site and readily available to that person while they're working. That was not reasonable in the size of a lab. Again, he was willing to continue and do that process. The other option he had was reciprocity. He attempted to go through the reciprocity channel, and of the 14 states, he did come from a state that had a registration requirement and was told by the board that that was not a qualified license for him to come into the state of Oregon. He eventually gave up his fight. We gave up our fight. Secondly, I had a position in my department, which was for a clinical supervisor. And when you think of a clinical supervisor needs an extensive amount of experience in order to supervise others. One of the applicants that I had came from one of our southern states, again, had been in the field for 10 to 14 years and had extensive experience, including supervisory experience. There was no pathway by which she could come into our state and receive a license without, again, indirect supervision, direct supervision, thus a supervisor who is now being supervised by her subordinates. Not a logical pathway for her either. She also gave up her fight. It's important to know that the CAHEP, which is the Commission of Accreditation for Allied Health Educational Programs, which is the educational pathway that the academic pathway for the licensure follows, that type of schooling has only been around for since 2006. In the whole country, there's only 43 of those schools. In the state of Oregon, there's only 2 of those schools. So
wrap it up, please.
Yes, absolutely. I pretty much have wrapped up.
Okay.
Along with Legacy, we would like you to consider this, accepting this bill and recognizing that this is a combination of education and training, not solely on the job and not solely training.
Hello. Good afternoon. My name is Erica Kennett. I am a registered polysomnographic technologist, and I am the clinical supervisor of the Sleep Disorders Center at Legacy Good Samaritan Medical Center. I wanted to let you know a little bit about my personal experience becoming licensed in the state of Oregon. I entered the polysomnography field in 2007 in Ohio, which is a state that doesn't require licensure of polysom techs. But I did go through a combined education and experience program, one of the KHEP programs, Jan referenced, that is recognized by Oregon. In 2012, I finished my master's in health administration and began a nationwide job search, finally finding a good fit with Legacy Health in Portland, prepared to move my family across the country. At the time that I applied for licensure in Oregon, I discovered that the licensure rules require this national credentialing exam, the RPSGT, or Registered Polysomnographic Technologist exam, to have been passed within the previous 2 years before the date of application. I had been registered since 2008 and had just renewed my registration, so I called the Oregon Health Licensing Office to clarify, and they confirmed that by the current ruling of the administrative rules, I had essentially held my credential too long to qualify for licensure without retaking this $450 exam. I then contacted the Board of Registered Polysomnographic Technologists, who offers the RPSGT exam, and found out that they didn't allow current credential holders to retake the exam. Ultimately, the Oregon Health Licensing Office had to call them and explain the situation, and they have since made a specific exemption to their rules about retaking the exam, specifically for techs in Oregon seeking licensure. Additionally, due to the processing time it took after I applied to resit for this exam, I was unable to take that until after I had moved to Oregon, which meant that Legacy Health couldn't give me a formal job offer until this was in place. Essentially, I moved my family 2,400 miles on good faith of a verbal offer and my confidence that I would be able to pass this exam again, which
Leaving
I did.
Ohio was worth it, certainly.
Yeah. I left Ohio, too.
I was most recently
good
in Columbus.
Shot. That was good.
As you can imagine, this was incredibly stressful, not to mention time-consuming and costly while I was moving across the country. However, I am thankful that the polysomnography education program, the KHEP program I went through, was one of the KHEP programs that Oregon does recognize currently for licensure. If I had started in the field before 2006 and had gone through one of the longer-standing programs, I would have been ineligible for a permanent license, just as the two examples Jan gave. Basically, the current rules prevent the people of Oregon from benefiting from the expertise of the most experienced polysom techs in the field. They're also inconsistent with national standards by recognizing just the most recent of numerous education programs that are recognized by our gold standard credentialing body, which is actually an international credential. I also strongly support the passage of House Bill 2305 to allow educated, experienced techs to work in Oregon, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there questions of this panel?
Quick.
Yes, sir. Chair Hayden.
Chair Greenlee, thank you. Is there an opportunity to sit down and kind of come to a common sense kumbaya moment with the board and say this really doesn't make sense?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, there was a pending rulemaking before the board. We have the agency here, and I want to say real clearly that the agency staff has been great to work with. This is not a criticism of the agency staff. Ms. Mercer and her staff have been very helpful in this process. There was a pending rulemaking when this sort of came to light to us, and we actually intervened in that rulemaking to ask to make the change. And it only happened about a couple weeks before the hearing, and there really wasn't enough time to probably fully vet and explain it, and the change wasn't made. We then filed a formal petition for rulemaking, which is a formal process that allowed for all agencies, gives the agency 90 days, a maximum of 90 days to respond. The staff was in a very problem-solving mood. I think it's fair to say the board was not in a problem-solving mood, and none of the suggestions that came from any of the participants from outside the board were deemed acceptable to the board. So I think we had no choice in this case but to come back here. It is one of the problems, I think, that some boards have. They have adopted their rules. They really like their rules. They're sometimes unwilling to think that another way might be equally good or maybe even better. So that's the problem. I would hesitate to speak for Ms. Mercer and her staff, but I think if the staff were in control of this, we would have come to a kumbaya moment rather than the board.
Okay, thank you guys very
much. Thank you very much.
We have two more witnesses in favor and three in opposition. Why don't we call the two more in favor or neutral first, and then we'll end with the three who are in.
James Blevins and Jessica Adamson.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is James Blevins. I'm the program director for OHSU's Sleep Disorders Program. I'm also a registered polysomnographic technologist. OHSU supports House Bill 2305 to remove barriers in state licensure pathways for RPSGTs, the short acronym way to say it. Allowing experienced out-of-state sleep technologists who have the appropriate education and training to work in Oregon is vital to ensure our citizens have access to and receive the best care from qualified individuals at Oregon sleep centers. Our program at OHSU employs 13 RPSGTs and provides comprehensive evaluation treatment of sleep disorders in both adults and children. We're probably unique in seeing both adults and children. Most programs are adults or children. We treat nearly 2,300 patients each year. We've had significant difficulty recruiting and employing qualified individuals since January 2013 because of the barriers created for licensure. Prior to that, we were able to fill open positions within 30 days. It now takes us up to 6 months to fill those jobs when we looked at the average since then, which has created long wait times for patients to receive care at our facilities. Currently, our average wait time to be treated, diagnosed in the sleep lab is 10 to 12 weeks. We had a total of 9 open positions since that time, ranging from relief to full-time positions. 11 of those applicants were experienced polysomnographic technologists out of 77, with experience ranging from 3 to 15 years, but current requirements prevent them from being eligible for licensure in Oregon. We understand that the licensure rules were originally intended to protect patients and ensure quality of care, but in practice, we've seen these rules lead to a significant decrease in the qualifications and quality of eligible applicants. Two of our most qualified and best technologists were hired prior to January 2013, and without House Bill 2305, we would be unable to hire them today or in the future. We strongly encourage your support of House Bill 2305 with amendments that make it clear that the board must allow experienced polysomnographic technologists to obtain a license in Oregon if they have obtained and maintained the nationally recognized professional credential through one of the combinations of education and training recognized by the National Credentialing Organization.
I have two questions. Do you know roughly how many polysomnic technicians there are in the state currently?
I have no idea.
And the second question, can a respiratory therapist serve the same function in your sleep labs?
Same function? So they would be eligible for license, but don't perform the same duties or have the same training performed without being trained as we would someone from the ground up with no training.
But from a licensure perspective, could a respiratory therapist serve that
significant? Yes.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. We're here to speak in favor of House Bill 2305. We think this is an important bill that will enable us to be able to hire the best of the best to provide excellent patient care in this state. We believe it's important to be able to bring in folks with experience and be able to have them licensed in a reasoned way in Oregon. We support the amendments talked about by my colleague at OHSU as well as Legacy, and we want to applaud Legacy for really leading the industry in trying to resolve this issue. We've been supporting their efforts all the way from the initial rulemaking at the agency level, and and look forward to continuing to work to try and resolve this issue so that patients have access to timely care in this important area. Thank you.
Thank you both. Are there any questions? Thank you. Would you call the next panel, please?
April Vaness.
Venice,
okay. Marilyn Barkley, and Kathy Malero.
That's all the people we have signed up for this bill.
Correct.
Please identify yourself when you start.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is April Venice. I teach respiratory therapy and physiology at Oregon Institute of Technology. About 12 million Americans have obstructive sleep apnea. And this is a referenced quote that I'm speaking of from the epidemiology of obstructive sleep apnea. Sleep apnea is a deadly disease because people with this disorder abruptly stop breathing when they aren't awake and are unable to help themselves. People with moderate or severe sleep apnea, the people who are most likely to undergo sleep studies, are 6 times more likely to die than people without the disease. This is also a quote. They are also more likely to die suddenly. And I have the references to the quotes with you from the various articles. Sudden death from sleep apnea is preventable if professional respiratory therapists respond immediately to rescue the dying patient. House Bill 2305 gives licenses for sleep technology to minimally trained, otherwise inexperienced members of the public. House Bill 2305 exposes Oregonians to too much risk. Let's be perfectly clear. Passing this bill would be a deadly mistake. Thank you for your attention.
You want to expand on that a little bit?
As a...
Yes, the assertion that it would be a deadly mistake. That's a pretty strong assertion.
As I mentioned, people with apnea have potential to die by 6 times more than the average.
Right, I understand. And I understand the epidemiology, but the question is, is bringing into the state people that have passed a national exam, nationally certified, and maintain their national certification, that would lead to deaths? Is that what you're saying?
As a patient advocate, the amount of training that is required to assess and see the situation coming to death is required. And if we don't have people that are qualified to see this in the sense of assessment, it won't be caught soon enough. And then those who are called to do the resuscitation, they're there already if they're a respiratory therapist.
But you've examined those national standards that the national standards that are included in this proposal. This proposal only allows people that have passed the national exam and are nationally certified.
Mm-hmm.
Have you examined those standards? Are they lacking in that? Are those people?
From what I understand,
I can speak to that.
Yeah,
please talk about what elements of that are lacking.
My name is Marilyn Barkley, and I'm a registered respiratory therapist with over 4 years of experience in Oregon. And I'm also a registered polysomnographer. I am responsible for managing cardiopulmonary and neurodiagnostic services at a Willamette Valley Hospital. I also served on the OHLA board for 9 years. And during that time was when we passed the law, the licensure law. So speaking to the reasons why...
We passed the licensure law.
Okay. I'm sorry. It felt like we did. And actually, it's an advisory board, so they don't really have any power, per se. It's advisory only. The reason that the rules were passed in the way that they were to keep people who had maybe taken the polysomnography test in the past, maybe 10 years ago or 10 years before licensure went into effect, but then didn't practice. And so they didn't really have the experience or keep up with the changes in the field. So that was the reason behind the 2-year limitation on.
Those folks would have maintained their certification but not practice. Can you maintain your certification without practice?
Yes, sir.
How do you do that?
There really isn't an. If you pass the test, you pass the test.
You don't have to practice.
You have to be. The question is, if you pass the test and then continue to be recertified, can you be recertified without practicing?
There is no recertification.
There is no recertification.
We should let them finish. Yeah. I think there's people that disagree, so we should let them finish and get this out, and then.
Thank you.
Keep up your
pulse and IV. Sure, I appreciate your help. Yes, go ahead, please.
May I continue with my prepared comments? I'm going to actually, you've all have them in front of you, I assume. So in January of 2013, that was when the polysomnography law went into effect and allowed to grandfather in everyone who had been practicing polysomnography up to that point. And you also had to take those exams, the two recognized exams by the OHLA, and one of those is the National Board of Respiratory Therapy's sleep specialist, sleep disorder specialist, and then the registered polysomnography exam. Oregon's rules are stringent. No ifs, ands, or buts about it, they are. Also, in Oregon, polysomnographers are allowed to titrate oxygen and titrate ventilator settings, and that isn't the case in all states. So that was another reason why it was felt at the time that the laws needed to be so stringent. I just believe that removing some of those rules is a bad practice and puts patients at risk. To address the issues of people having trouble trying to replace the open positions, when Legacy put this before the OHLA, and I was not on the board at that point in time, and the board unanimously denied their request, is my understanding. So that's why it's come to before you. So the three cases that I'm aware of where they were unable to hire out-of-state people, in reality, one of those people was already a respiratory therapist and as such was able to practice polysomnography in the state of Oregon. And the other was eligible to sit for the RPSGT exam, did so and passed, and took the job. And the third took a job in California where license and registration, or there are registered but not licensed. Both Lynn Benton Community College and Oregon Institute of Technology have polysomnography programs. And with the rising, or the healthcare hiring slump that's occurred in the last few years, there's a lot of people sitting out there waiting to get jobs. People have been unable to find employment. The respiratory therapist graduates also have had difficulty securing employment, and RT training makes it really, those graduates very attractive candidates for cross-training, and they're able to practice polysomnography under Oregon law. As a healthcare manager, I realize times are really tight. Hospitals are in survival mode, and everybody's looking for ways to cut costs. But I really hope that we haven't reached the point where putting patients at risk, we put patients at risk to save money. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Kathy Malero. I'm also assistant manager at Good Samaritan Regional Medical Center and the manager of Neurodiagnostic and Sleep Lab, as well as the president of the Oregon Society for Respiratory Care. To answer that question about continuing your credential without actually practicing, you can have so many C continuing education, and that was originally, we were working close with the Northwest Sleep Association, Pacific Northwest Sleep Association, back when we were hashing out the regulations, and that is why they were stringent. And we wanted to promote the polysonographers wanted to promote their profession, not kind of backslide, and that is why the rules were there. And I was at the public hearing for the at the OHLA, and it was my understanding that the OHLA advisory board felt that out of the three examples, two of them got licensures. Yeah, it was a little harder to get, but they did receive licensure. So that seemed reasonable to me. But also as a manager and having a managing a sleep lab, I've recently had to replace a polysonographer, and I've found through Lynn Benton Community College and the OIT program, there is 30 to 40 qualified and experienced polysonographers in Oregon now. So we are just trying to keep the standard that polysonographers and respiratory therapists had achieved when this was a new board and new licensure. Awesome. Thank you.
Any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if you have data. I didn't see it in the material section of OLIS, but perhaps you could send it to us, that shows the difference in quality for states that so you enacted stricter standards here than the national certification. I'd love to know why you did that, what the data shows in places that don't have that kind of stricter certification that Oregon requires.
I think we should be able to come up with that.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask Ms. Mercer to join us in a bit for a minute, but if you have questions of this group, ready, Holly.
Chair Green, thank you. So you kind of said once licensed, always licensed. I believe there's a two-year requirement in most health professionals licensed to do continuing education. Is that not true with your board?
That is true.
Okay, so it kind of, if you don't keep that up, you kind of fall off of that. And my question is there opportunity, same question I asked the last panel, is there opportunity, I'm not a big proponent of the legislature getting involved with the micromanagement of these boards, if there's an opportunity to negotiate it outside of that. Is there that opportunity?
Let's ask the licensing agency person to
they probably
that
can
question.
Speak to that better. I do want to clarify, though. Yes, you're absolutely right that there are, that people who are licensed have requirements to maintain continuing education in order to maintain their license. But what we're saying is that somebody could have passed the polysomnography test and not practiced in many years, and they wouldn't have been licensed, but then they if this goes into effect, they would be eligible for licensure.
Well, I may have understood the notion of this bill, but the bill would allow people who have passed the national test and certified the national test and maintained their certification. Is that not how you understood what
that
this bill does?
There is no certification.
What happens after you pass the national board? What do you get? You get a license? You get a certificate?
No, you don't get a license. You get a plaque, and you're considered to be a registered polysomnographer.
Okay. Maintain their registration.
Yes.
What
it's
do they
complicated.
Have to, my understanding is these are people who maintain their registration, which I thought I heard you just say, requires continuing education.
I don't know. I would have to look at the bill again to know whether or not that is true.
If that is true, would that make you feel
yes,
more comfortable about
it
this?
It would, definitely.
Okay. Well, then I suggest you relook at the bill.
Okay.
It's true.
Thank you. Ms. Mercer, can you please join us?
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for coming over. Holly, can you shed any light on what's going on here?
Perhaps. Perhaps. Chair Greenlake, vice chairs, members of the committee, my name is Holly Mercer. I'm the executive director for the Health Licensing Office. First of all, I do have the numbers. It's around 280 licensed polysoms. We'll make it short. But I do want to clarify that I feel that proponents of this bill have made every effort possible to change the rules through the administrative rules process, through public comment at the board. We just had an impasse with the board, and at least during my tenure, I do rely on the professionals of, we oversee 12 boards with 84 different board members, and we need to rely on their professional expertise. So I do think this might be one of those rare instances, Representative Hayden, that we were not able to resolve this at an administrative level, and that's why it's back before you today. I would like to add also, we probably need to educate the committee more about the national certification, whether they have ongoing, my understanding was they had ongoing continuing education requirements, and my understanding is that that was what the proponents were seeking. We would want to make sure that the bill language does reflect that. So we just received this amendment today. So although our office is neutral on the bill, we try to make these this legislation as easy and fiscally responsible to put it at an operational level. So that's kind of where we stand, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? It's a part answer to your question.
Yeah, answered that. Yeah.
As always, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
My suggestion is before we leave today, is there a possible work session on this?
No, no. No.
Okay, so we won't adopt the amendment yet.
No, no. And Mr. Chair, it's come to my attention that the ones aren't as explicit as the proponents had wanted, and they have a solution for a possible two. If you want to give them 30 seconds to just put that on the record, if not, we can hold it till later.
No, that'd be a great idea. Have you asked for the two already?
No.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing Legacy Health. No, we have not submitted the two. We're still working to make sure that is absolutely clear and explicit to provide that passing the national exam and qualifying it through a combination of education and training that they have set their current standards for that, plus maintaining it and taking your continuing education is what we're talking about, just as I think you've heard it described. The dash one was our first attempt at that. We didn't think it was clear enough. We don't even think the base bill is quite clear enough. But that is the intent, and that's where we're going. So we're going to try to make sure that it goes through all the necessary channels to have everybody's input, to make sure it provides for that, and then we'll submit it through your staff to be drafted.
It would be useful for Ms. Mercer to be a part of that.
She most certainly will be.
That's great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, all the witnesses that are here. I appreciate you coming. I think I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2305. We'll reschedule it as soon as we get an amendment that we can work on. And we are adjourned. We are adjourned.